Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Leading Ideas Talks is also brought to you by Taking Clergy Mentoring to the Next Level. This video-based training resource is designed for clergy mentors who wish to prepare for a more effective ministry of mentorship. Taking Clergy Mentoring to the Next Level is available in both individual and group training versions at churchleadership.com/mentor. What is pastoral imagination, and how can it be nurtured by clergy and laity? We speak with Eileen Campbell Reed about how clergy can cultivate and nurture pastoral imagination in order to address conflict, experience joy, and develop a deep, wise knowing.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I am Jessica Anschutz, one of the editors of the Leading Ideas e-newsletter, and I am your host for this Leading Ideas Talk. Joining me is Eileen Campbell Reed, visiting associate professor of pastoral theology and care at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. She's also the co-director of the Learning Pastoral Imagination Project and author of Pastoral Imagination, Bringing the Practice of Ministry to Life. Welcome, Eileen. I enjoyed reading your book, and I'm glad to be with you today to talk about pastoral imagination.
Thank you so much, Jessica. I'm delighted to be here and chatting with you about the book and all things pastoral imagination.
As we start off, why don't you talk some more about pastoral imagination? Tell us what it is and tell us what has drawn your attention to it as a study and research topic.
Sure. It's pretty helpful to think about pastoral imagination at this moment in time as three things. It is my new book, which we're going to talk about today. It is also a research project, which Chris Sharon and I have been working on since the beginning of 2009. So we're going into our 12th year here. And it is also a concept, and that's what's at the heart of both the research project and the book. The concept of pastoral imagination is an idea that was coined by Craig Dykstra in the late 1990s. And he was convening groups of practitioners, pastors, ministers, and also theological educators to think about the pastoral life and work and what was it about? How do we understand it? In that period of time, people had begun to think more and more, not just about what we think, but also what we do. It's about an embodied, relational, and even holy way of being in the world. And he wrote about this in multiple places. And then about 10 or so years after he had this idea and started circulating it, Chris and I picked up on it. And Chris actually wrote a grant inviting us into this work of studying. So what is pastoral imagination and how do people learn it over time? Because it's not something you simply learn in a classroom and then go out and do. It is a skilled practice. It integrates knowing and doing and being. And in that holistic way, over time, comes to life, as I said in my book, in these really beautiful, embodied, and powerful ways. And it has to do with also we've made the connection to Aristotle's idea of phronesis. And phronesis is practical wisdom. So this is a pastoral imagination is a way of being a minister or pastor that sees into the fullness of a situation and knows what to do and takes a risk and does it and then takes responsibility for what was done and learns from those mistakes. They don't always go the way we want, right? And over time, instance after instance, experience after experience, we develop a deep, wise knowing.
In thinking about cultivating pastoral imagination, do you have tips or words of wisdom for clergy as they seek to further enhance their pastoral imagination?
Absolutely. The first thing to say about that is that just do it. Try, practice, get on the bike. I have a bike sitting here beside me to remind me all the time, a little small bike that's bookends for books to sit between, reminding me that learning pastoral imagination is a lot like learning any other practice. Cooking, tennis, riding a bike. And there's a beginning point when we don't really know what we're doing at all. We just see it out there. We think, I want to do that. You know, when we're kids, we wanted to ride that bicycle. It was the most, exciting thing to do to learn it. But think about how long that took. For me, it was months, I'm sure, and training wheels and falling off and figuring out how to keep my balance on that bike. And learning ministry is really not that different, only we're adults when we start. So we think we're supposed to know everything to do already. In fact, we don't. We need to take time to see what other people are doing, the people that we admire about how they embody pastoral imagination in the world. And we try to emulate them to begin with. And eventually we find our own ways of doing things like preaching and giving care and leading a meeting and organizing volunteers. And all of those are part skills that are part of this larger capacity to embody pastoral imagination in the world. And it's also seeing the really painful, broken parts of the world and having some sense about how to respond and how to lead people to respond. The only way to learn that is not sitting in a classroom reading books and writing papers. Those are valuable parts of information that we need. But that's one slice of what the robust practice of pastoral imagination would be. And so we need to go ahead and practice soon and often. And I encourage my students to start practicing being a minister long before they're called to a church or ordained for ministry. Get your hands in the work. Get your body into the spaces where you're leading. And you're going to know so much more faster if you, not that it's about being fast, but you're going to get it. You're going to make connections a lot quicker if you're doing something.
That's wonderful. I really enjoy your image or metaphor of riding a bike and learning how to ride a bike. And I remember when I was learning how to ride a bike, not only did I have training wheels, but I had my parents and often my dad alongside helping me learn the ropes. And I am mindful that there's a connection back to pastoral ministry in that you're not doing the work alone. You have colleagues that you can rely on and also the laity that you're serving. So how can laity nurture pastoral imagination in their pastors?
It's a wonderful metaphor. The bike rider, especially the young bike rider, needs a person to go along behind them or beside them and show them. And we borrow their experience then. Our bodies, our brains are full of mirror neurons. And so we see someone doing something and we also, our bodies will attempt to do a similar thing. Even now, as I'm nodding, you're nodding. This is the way mirror neurons work. And so mentors in ministry can be a kind of mirroring for people who are learning the practice of ministry. Now, it's not that we simply need to emulate some other person or try to be like them. It's that we can borrow from their wisdom and from their embodied practice. We see them interact with a person who's really upset or anxious or acting out in a way that's disruptive to a community, for instance. And when a pastor approaches that situation and does it artfully and skillfully, we can see how they do that. We can start to think, well, how would I, in that same situation, do that? So we borrow from their experience. We also, in conversation with them, borrow from their wisdom, what they know, their insights. And they, on the other side, can be incredibly encouraging and make space for us to, if we're the learners, to think about what we're doing. I think in congregations, Particularly, it's helpful when there are lay people who've been seasoned ministers and leaders in the church themselves. They may not have the title pastor, but they know how the church works. They know how things can happen in a good way, and they know how to love people. And when those lay people can love the new minister and be patient and allow them a lot of room to learn from not just getting it right, but also missteps, and they have a lot of grace for that new minister, it makes a world of difference in how one can confidently learn and practice. Because if one is in a place where, I felt a little of this when I got out of seminary myself, right? I thought I'd been to school for 3.5 years and I'd been through clinical pastoral education and I had my degree and I was supposed to know what to do. And in fact, I didn't know a lot of things about what to do. I had to learn. And the stress I put on myself, the pressure I put on myself to do everything well, backfired on me more than once. And so when congregants for instance, staff at a hospital, if we're talking about chaplains, or people in an organization when a new leader comes out of seminary and starts to work with them, when they have the patience to let someone find their way, be in conversation, not leave them out to hanging out to dry and just figure it out on your own, that's not kind or encouraging either. But we'll come alongside the person and say, wow, this is amazing. What are you learning? Tell me about it. It gives that young or new minister who might not be so young an opportunity to reflect on what they're learning and to do it together and to learn how to lead collaboratively. I think that's an important part of learning to do ministry well and embody a robust pastoral imagination.
Collaboration is certainly key in ministry, and I'm so grateful that you lifted up the need for love and grace. Because what more does our world need, and do our clergy and laity need in the midst of their ministry? As you were talking, Eileen, I recognize that there's another group, I guess, that comes alongside of recent seminary graduates, and that is either the board or committee that is part of the denomination that evaluates candidates for ministry. How can those bodies effectively assess and also help nurture a candidate's pastoral imagination?
I'm so glad you asked that, because rarely do people realize how important those key figures are. But there are those middle people who help make the connection between the new minister and their ministry site, whatever that is, hospital, congregation, organization. And I think that if they themselves, in their work of accompanying people from training through ordination and into their full-time service or part-time service, we know the world is changing and many people will have part-time ministry work in their futures. If they themselves have a sense of this trajectory, that people start as beginners or novices and they move to a kind of time of competence, and eventually, many years into ministry probably are going to be more proficient at what they do, and eventually wise, perhaps even expert ministers. And so again, a lot of patience and generosity and an ability to try to imagine what are the gifts and what are the potentials in the person in front of me, so that I can think, yeah, in a few more years, wow, this person will have developed more experience and will be able to move with more confidence and grace in their work.
We need to view people at the entering point and extend to them more love and grace as they go along. Are there particular things when you think about sort of the evaluation of candidates that would help these adjudicatories in shifting to be a more nurturing and supportive body and more focused on pastoral imagination than perhaps academic knowledge? Are there particular things you can think of?
I think one of the things that's probably most helpful is to start thinking about if those folks are doing evaluations, as we do in seminary as well. As a professor, I'm doing the same kind of evaluation also. And to ask questions about integration, that would be more helpful often than simply asking people to rehearse what they know. They need to know theology. They need to know how to interpret the Bible. They need to know how to teach and preach and do the skills that we think of as the arts of ministry. All of that's given. I'm not questioning any of those things. I'm saying, how are they asking questions to the candidates about how they're integrating their knowing and their being and their doing, a sort of framework that a lot of schools actually use. And it can be questions like this: how have you changed over time? Like, you came into seminary and you were thinking about ministry perhaps in a certain way. How has your thinking changed about ministry in the time you've been in your training process? That gives the adjudicatories an idea about how the person is integrating their thinking. They're integrating their being, like how they understand their own call and how they understand the work of ministry. And to ask for stories, not just to ask for, can you give me the right answers? Which is typically asked of people at beginner stages in all kinds of things. But can you tell me about a time when something happened? Can you tell me about a learning moment? We ask about aha moments in the Learning Pastoral Imagination Project when we're interviewing people. And when you ask people, tell us about an aha moment, they tell you some really powerful stories about how they learned. And you see a little glimpse into how they've changed from being beginners to maybe moving toward competency. And I think asking about their experiences in field education and CPE, et cetera, you learn a lot more about what they'll do when a difficult situation comes along and how they navigated something difficult. And that kind of information, those stories, actually tell you a lot about how a person's going to do somewhere else, far more than their ability to tell you what Paul Tillich or Sally McFaig said about a theological doctrine. theological doctrine is very important, but it's not going to tell you exactly how a person's going to do in a difficult situation or a crisis situation or whatever. So I think the more integrative kinds of questions, stories, and tell us how you've changed are the kinds of questions that adjudicatories could benefit from asking.
I want to shift gears to your book. And one of the things that I noted in reading it is that you share so many wonderful stories from ministers, from pastors, from their experience in the practice of ministry. And so certainly you've gathered these stories through your research, but why don't you give our listeners some background about how your book came to be?
Sure. So the Learning Pastoral Imagination Project really got off the ground in 2009. So we began right away by recruiting students or about to graduate seminarians from 10 schools. And those were across the country, very different a wide range of denominations: Pentecostal, Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Mainline, Evangelical, Mennonite, or Peace Church. So we have people in the study of 50, a cohort of 50, who are from a lot of different backgrounds. We also interviewed 25 senior ministers in the same early years of the study to kind of cheat on the end of the longitudinal study to see what very wise, experienced ministers might sound like, what their stories would be. And so you can imagine, as we interviewed those 75 people, we amassed an enormous number of stories from their lives because we ask very open-ended, very few questions in an interview day. We bring groups of five people together. We ask them questions about how they came to that point in their lives, about aha moments they've learned, and what has prepared them for ministry. Those were the questions we asked in the first round. And those questions yielded, 7 hours of transcription and conversation. And really powerful stories about how people learn and practice. I don't really set out for this to happen, but inevitably at the end of every interview, I find myself very emotional and very moved by the stories that we've been entrusted with and the experiences that people share with us. And it really truly feels like we are on holy ground with them when we have spent the full day hearing what has been happening in their lives and in their ministries. And they listen deeply to each other. We all ask good, open questions. And they're partners in this process of our learning. So it's been incredible. And the book I wrote has stories from many, not quite all, but many, many people who were in our, who are in our study. And so when you're reading about someone, they have a different name and maybe a different location, but it's very much their story. And they've also given us permission, me permission, to put that story in the book.
As you think about these stories and in the book, how do you see the stories empowering or enabling or supporting people, pastors, in cultivating the pastoral imagination? What is your hope for those stories?
Yeah. One is I hope that it will be affirming to the person who reads it to say, oh, that's, I'm not the only one who's experienced that. When somebody doesn't learn till their third call that they need to show up every time there's a person in their congregation going into surgery or for a major cancer treatment, you know, they can say, I've forgotten some things too, so maybe I'm not the only one. And they can also, maybe they're new, so new at the beginning of their training, they haven't had that opportunity yet to miss that. And so they have that story to say, I am not going to let that happen. It's a kind of learning from the mistakes of others that's really powerful. We learn from our own mistakes. We also learn really a lot from the mistakes that others are willing to let us in on. And so I want people to recognize themselves. I want them to learn from the missteps. I want them to look at the questions that I ask in every chapter and ask themselves those questions now and more than once, because they're very, those questions are really questions of learning and practice. And so they ask the person who reads them to think reflectively about their own lives and how, what would they do in these 50 different situations, because the book is full of 50 different topics or situations that they might encounter. And so it helps them anticipate, what would I do? So that's the fourth thing. It helps them anticipate what ministry might be like in a more close to the ground, more realistic, like this actually happened. It wasn't an ideal situation. It's a real situation. And to think about how to enlist mentors for themselves, to start to imagine. We say there's a shift that happens from imagining ministry to embodying pastoral imagination. And that shift sometimes comes almost suddenly in a moment, what one of our participants called a holy cow moment. But really, it also is a shift that's happening gradually over time. So I want people to have that sense of, I'm on a long-term learning process. I'm a long curve here, and I'm going to be learning a lot as I go. The final thing I would say about that is when we enter into a new situation, for instance, we step into a meeting and there's a huge amount of tension and people are about to break into a fight. You know, you just feel it as the minister walking into the room, and they look to you because you're the minister who walked into the room, and they want you to do something, to say something, to show up in a particular pastoral way. At that moment, you have to draw on everything you've got. You have to draw on everything you know, all the theology you've read, everything in the scriptures, everything you've experienced, all the feelings that you sense in the room, an attentiveness to the holy. You've got to just pull together so much in that moment. And one of the metaphors I like for that is that it's like in my theological training and in my ministry, I built this library of cases in my interior life. And I can pull from that library anytime I need to. Certain moments will feel like very similar to other moments. And I know to pull out, what did I do then? Oh, don't do that again. Or, oh, I saw a person deal with a very similar situation. I'm going to borrow from that. Now, in real life, we don't have time to deliberate in the way I just did out loud. Instead, we step into that room where there's a fight about to break out, and we need to say something immediately, do something, call people to a different way to be together. And so it feels like what we would call intuition. But in fact, we are drawing on a sedimented kind of knowing that is pastoral imagination. It's sedimented into layers and layers of stories. So my book gives you a head start on a lot of other people's stories about beginning in ministry. You have all of them in your library in addition to the experiences you personally have. So it gives people a little jump start on their library of what they're going to draw on that becomes part of their pastoral imagination.
I think most clergy and many laity encounter conflict in their congregations. And I'm so glad that you raised that and that you also address it in the book. In thinking about navigating conflict, you cannot navigate conflict well or poorly. Are there aspects of pastoral imagination that help clergy navigate conflict well? And what are they?
It's one of those things that we can't give an answer for. We can't say, lots of people do try to write rules about conflict, right? You need to take this step, this step, this step. And they're not terrible rules. But the reality is when we enter into a live in the moment situation, it may not adhere itself to the rules that we know. Rules are a low level of learning. And so we do want to learn some rules and sometimes what we might call rules of thumb, some guidelines for how to approach. For instance, listening. Listening is a really great guideline for how to approach almost any human activity, leading, or dealing with conflict or anything else. So certainly we want people to have that as a basic. They need to listen. But we also know that there comes moments where listening is not the thing that needs to happen because there's a crisis underway and actually we need to say something, not just stand around and listen. And so a true, competent, proficient, or expert sort of wise pastoral imagination knows without deliberating what the right response is. When you're new, you don't know. So you, again, draw on everything. It's good to have all those rules. It's good to have learned some theories about how conflict works, some ideas about how to navigate a crisis. Your seminary should give you lots of that, I hope. and you need all that in the moment, but you also need to be willing to improvise and trust your gut, because what your gut is a distillation of everything you know. It's not some magical, off in the stratosphere thing, or just the feather of the Holy Spirit. It might be that too, but it's really a distillation of everything you know in a moment. And learning to practice a kind of pastoral presence in that moment is the real key. And the only way to do it is to do it. And the only way to do it is to practice it. So it means taking risk. And taking risks is it's scary. We don't always want to do that. But that is a part of the pastoral life. And also recognizing what's at stake. That's a big thing that becomes like a kind of hurdle to get over. So in terms of dealing with conflict, let's go back to your question. What do I want people to do? I want them to take a breath when they get into that moment. And I want them to really survey just quickly, scan the room. What is at stake here? It might be what's obvious or it might be something less obvious. And if you can take just that breath to think, what is really at stake here? Then you can also probably take a half step back and realize, I don't need to enter in just on the level of what's going on in this conflict. I need to remind people of the big picture, why we're here, how we love each other, and what we're going to do to listen together. Or if there's an immediate crisis, you're going to step in a pastoral way and bring a kind of calm, non-anxious presence. So there's all different, I've just named all different kinds of ways of entering into a conflicting moment. There's no one answer for it. There is becoming improvisational in one's ability to draw on what's needed in that moment. And again, experience is the best way to get there. And putting yourself into situations like field education, clinical pastoral education, being the summer camp pastor, or whatever your opportunities are to learn soon and early, is going to make you more ready for what comes later.
I thank you so much for taking this time to talk with me. Eileen, as we wrap up, are there any final words that you would like to offer our listeners about pastoral imagination?
You know, one of the reasons I chose the bike as a metaphor for the opening part of this book and talk about the, you know, it's learning ministries like learning to ride a bike in a certain kind of way, is because there's also a tremendous amount of joy in riding a bike once you know how. It's got risk, it's got a little bit of danger, but it's also exhilarating, fun, joyous, and ministry is that too. The final chapter in the book is about embracing joy. And so whatever your calling is, lay minister, pastor, chaplain, activist, whatever that call is, I hope that you keep leaning into the joy of it and kind of feel the wind of the Spirit in your hair or in your clothes as you make your way. You know, that metaphor just sings to me about the joy of what this work can be. So that's the blessing I offer, is the blessing of joy in the work of ministry, no matter how hard or challenging it might be to you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Eileen.
It's been a delight to talk with you, Jessica. Thank you for this conversation. I'm grateful.
On the next Leading Ideas Talks, Phil Cook shares how your congregation can become more digitally savvy.
I tell pastors very often that I'm glad your sermon is anointed. I'm glad your worship is fantastic. But in an 8-second world, what's your parking experience like at your church? What's the lobby like? Who's the first person a new visitor meets when they walk in the door? Because in today's distracted culture, people are making those decisions long before they ever get to their seat. So I just think we need to understand, first of all, that first impression counts. We've always, you know, been told your first impression is the most important thing. Let me tell you, in a digital universe, it's the most important thing you could possibly do. And it's very hard to repair a bad first impression because people have just so many other things to do and they have other choices.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.